walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Darcy Dennett, director of The Champions, a documentary chiefly about the pit bulls rescued from Michael Vick's dogfighting ring. The film tracks the dogs that landed at organizations like Best Friends Animal Society in the face of pressure by PETA and the Humane Society of the United States to euthanize the animals, and we follow a handful of those dogs after they're placed in homes. The Champions widens out to explore other topics within the world of pit bull dogs, including their history, the myths and misconceptions surrounding the animals, breed discrimination laws, and their impact, and more. We'll hear about those issues and other aspects of the film when I speak with Darcy Dennett in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in this program, I'll speak briefly with Aaron Greenwood, formerly the animal welfare editor for Huffington Post, now a consultant at BarkBox, who recently wrote a deeply researched BarkPost piece about PETA's animal shelter that, whatever one's feelings about PETA, may be jarring. In addition, as a prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering tickets to see Ry Cooter, Sharon White, and Ricky Skaggs April 2nd at the Strass Center. Right now, though, let's meet Darcy with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Darcy Dennett to Talking Animals. Good morning, Darcy.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us this morning on Talking Animals. There are a bunch of things I want to get into about you and the film. But first, given how multifaceted this documentary really is, I'd kind of like to hear your description of The Champions, sort of as an elevator pitch.
Sure. The Champions is a story about the dogs rescued from Michael Vick's fighting ring. It's a story of second chances and redemption. It's really an uplifting, inspirational story that's really about the dogs and how far they've come since they were first rescued.
Okay, I like it. That's I think, the end of our elevator ride, and just perfectly timed. The Champions is your first feature film, but far from your first time behind the camera. Talk a little bit about your professional experience, particularly the work in recent years that may have served as a bit of a prelude to directing The Champions.
Sure. Well, I was the series producer of National Geographic series called Dogtown, which followed the work of Best Friends Animal Society at their sanctuary in southern Utah. So I spent about 2.5 years working with Best Friends, and I was on the ground when the dogs that were rescued from Michael Vick first arrived at the sanctuary, 22 dogs that were considered to be the most challenging of the dogs who had been rescued. So I probably spent about 2 months with the dogs when they first arrived. And one of the dogs that we feature in the documentary, named Cherry, was a dog that I actually filmed with when he first arrived during the series. So this is my first independent film, but yes, I have a long, I'm a television director producer, so that experience really helped me to learn how to film with dogs. Telling stories about dogs definitely isn't easy. And, you know, telling stories about these particular dogs was also, you know, very, very challenging.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, so obviously we're going to delve much more into that story, or those stories, really. But directing and producing a feature-length documentary is an enormous undertaking where lots of blood, sweat, and tears are required in large quantities, often to offset the notable absence of money and other resources. It's not quite the scenario Louis C.K. Riley described when presenting the Oscar for a documentary short, but it's close. I mean, either way, it's safe to say that the filmmaker really got to be propelled by great passion, or that doc just ain't going to happen. So was it partly through the experience of working on the TV show that you had that passion, or were there other factors sort of in your background or just related to dogs that also account for that passion?
Sure. Well, that's definitely true. I don't think anybody should embark upon making a documentary unless it's something that you really cannot stop thinking about. This is definitely, for me, I knew from my experience working with the dogs when they first arrived that they really just completely shattered the stereotypes that I had about what these dogs would be like. When people imagine dogs rescued from a fighting situation, they think one thing, but when they think of dogs rescued from Michael Vick's fighting ring, I think the stakes even go up higher. What I found when the dogs arrived at the sanctuary was that they weren't at all what I had imagined. Most of the dogs were under-socialized. They had had very little experience with people that was positive of any shape or form. And I just couldn't believe how misperceived these dogs were, how misperceived pit bulls were. And I think it was that sort of injustice that led me to feel that their story just really had to be told. I stayed in touch with my friends at Best Friends Animal Society, and I knew what was happening with these dogs over the course of years, that they were slowly being rehabilitated with the trainers at Best Friends Animal Society, and that they were going into homes across the country. And I just knew in my heart that their story is such an incredible story of resilience, and that these dogs were able to overcome odds that were nearly insurmountable, and to go on and to live in loving adoptive homes around the country. I just thought was incredibly inspirational.
Yeah.
An inspirational story for people that people could relate to as well. And so, yes, I probably spent about 3 years working on this film, and definitely every morning I would wake up pretty early and literally pretty much spring out of bed to work incredibly hard during the course of the day to make the film, because really it was something that really drove me. I really felt passionately about it. I felt that it was a story that really I desperately wanted to share, and because of my experience working as a series producer of Dogtown, it was one that I sort of felt that as a filmmaker, I was uniquely positioned to tell.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, over the course of the film, we meet and track a few of the dogs. You've already mentioned Cherry. There's also a Little Red and Johnny and Handsome Dan. So how did you zero in on those dogs? I mean, obviously you alluded to a sort of a relationship with Cherry from the TV series, but how otherwise did you select which ones we kind of track more closely over the course of the film?
Well, 93 minutes isn't actually a very long time to tell a story, so you do have to be really careful about which stories you're trying to tell. Part of the decision was based on which dogs we had followed in depth during the course of Dogtown, because I knew that we would be able to license footage from National Geographic from that series that showed what the dogs were first like when they were rescued. And Best Friends also does an incredibly good job of documenting the work that they do, so I knew that we would have footage that we also could get from them. And so partially the decision was based on that. We had spent quite a bit of time with Cherry during Dogtown, as well as Handsome Dan. And then Little Red is one of the five dogs featured in the film. I loved Little Red when she arrived at Dogtown, but we didn't have time to film with her. And in fact, she wasn't really ready to be filmed with when she first arrived. So Little Red was a dog that I'd always been interested in and now lives in Wyoming. And I really also wanted to try to follow dogs across the country because I really think pit bulls used to be considered the all-American dog. So part of what I was hoping to achieve was a sense of where these dogs had really landed in various homes across the country. We also filmed with a dog named Johnny, who went to Bad Rap, an organization in San Francisco. Johnny was hard not to film with because Johnny really is unreal. He seems like a movie star dog. The dog knows about 30, probably more than 30 tricks, including something I was heartbroken to have not included. He can do something called army crawl, which is kind of amazing. He sort of gets really low to the ground and crawls. But he's an incredible dog. He's a therapy dog. And so Johnny is sort of one of the shining stars of how far these dogs have actually come. And we also filmed with a radio host named Richard Hunter in Las Vegas and his dog Mel. And that choice was really made because Richard tells the story of Michael Vick so well.
Yeah.
He's so outspoken about it that we really wanted to be able to include that pretty unique story.
For sure. There's a wide scope, as you've sort of mentioned, I mean, even just geographically, but otherwise just within the dogs and some of the humans that we meet, including Richard Hunter. And really, as part of that, one of the themes of the Champions is healing. I mean, you mentioned Bad Rap, and we've already mentioned a couple times Best Friends Animal Society. So they took on a large number of dogs, and then we meet, again, in the film, the individuals and families who plucked those dogs from those places. So Johnny, who we talked about, became a therapy dog. One of my favorite things over the years is sort of double healing in the animal world. So Johnny healed from his horrendous experience as a so-called Vic dog, and now is providing comfort and healing to ill kids. But also one of the things I think it's really valuable and important about your film is that we also see in Handsome Dan, for example, that sometimes the healing can only go so far. Even now, I think he's too fearful to take walks. But they even have figured out that his family, you know, sort of a way to, they have this kind of stroller that they call the Popemobile, so he still gets out and walks around even if he's not comfortable taking traditional walks. So.
Yeah, that's actually a great question. For me, you know, this really is, the story isn't about Michael Vick. The story is really about the dogs and how far they've come. That's a story that that not many people know. And you're absolutely right. For me, I mean, this documentary is an ode to dogs. People have told me that they felt that the film was about love.
Mm-hmm.
We very consciously avoided visuals of dog fighting and cruelty to animals because the hope was that it would be a positive and uplifting story. But really, as you say, it isn't even just about the dogs. It's about the people who these dogs have touched along the way. Not only have the dogs come so incredibly far and are such a shining example of resilience and how far they've come, but the people who have helped them along the way, I think, get as much, if not more, from what they give to these dogs than the dogs do. It's really about the relationship that we people have to animals and the significance that they have in our lives, for sure.
Of course, there's healing, and there's, in this film, there's transformation. There's adaptation in all kinds of directions, human to animal and back again. So it's really powerful in that way just because there's just, again, what their experiences were that they came there. We'll talk a little bit more about that and how that affects some of the dogs. But let me first tell people, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Darcy Dennett, director of The Champions, a documentary tracking the pit bulls rescued from Michael Vick's dogfighting ring and examining other issues within the world of pit bull dogs. If you'd like to ask Darcy a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. It's really interesting to see, I mean, again, I guess what we can't really know for sure is what exactly some of those dogs' specific experiences were while still in the Michael Vick world. So that it's hard to probably allow for what we now see or we see over time in your film. Again, Johnny becoming a therapy dog, Handsome Dan still being fearful of a number of things, not being able to take traditional walks, and Little Red often wearing a jacket or whatever because there's so many scars on him. So what did you glean from just the way from starting the film till it was completed, those dogs, just those journeys that they took?
Well, that's another great question. You're absolutely right that there's no way that we can know what happened to the five dogs that we follow in the film. What their lives were each like at Michael Vick's compound were very likely very different from each other. They were different ages when they were rescued, so Johnny may have been rescued when he was much younger than the other dogs, which could also play a part in what his issues may have been when he was first rescued and how far he's been able to come. Handsome Dan, you know, is a beautiful, big, sort of what you would imagine in your head visually if you imagined a dog rescued from Michael Vick's fighting ring. Yet he is among the more fearful of the dogs who have been placed into adoptive homes. And in fact, Mel, another dog that we follow in the film, is very similar. Mel is still incredibly fearful of new situations to the same extent that Dan is, if not more. Cherry has come really far and has done incredibly well, as has Little Red. I'm not The USDA investigative report, which is a document that's just under 20 pages, and has multiple eyewitness accounts of what it might have been like at Michael Vick's fighting ring, I think most people probably aren't aware that most of the dogs in a situation like that will absolutely refuse to fight. It's very unusual for dogs or pit bulls to fight at all. And what happens when these dogs refuse to fight, they do something called testing or rolling to test the fight worthiness of the dog. And if the dog doesn't perform well, the dog is killed. And the USDA investigative report, these multiple eyewitnesses outline various ways in which the dogs are killed, many of which have the media has really not touched upon. They died in incredibly brutal ways. So the dogs were in a lose-lose situation. They either had to fight for their lives or they were killed. So, and then other dogs, let's say perhaps Cherry. Cherry has scars, but Cherry, when he arrived at the sanctuary, was really under-socialized. He was incredibly shut down. He was really shy. He would sit in a corner and refuse to accept affection or attention from a human. He was terrified and just entirely shut down. A dog like Cherry may have just been entirely ignored while he was at Michael Vick's compound, Bad News Kennels. It's possible that he was just entirely neglected. So, I mean, I don't think anyone will really ever know what these dogs' histories are like. But I think what's interesting is that they share this history and that they all emerged from the situation and had entirely different issues. So despite the shared background, each of them, like humans, reacted completely differently to the situation.
Yeah, it's really notable. I can't remember, but I think it's Little Red's nice lady that took him. And I guess speculating or having done a lot of research on sort of what the dreaded Michael Vick setup was like, had determined that there was these, first of all, everything was all blacked out and dark, so that's part of the issues that some of these dogs had, but just being out and about or daylight. But she also, I guess, had found that where the ring was, you had to go up these set of stairs to get to them. So Little Red, that was not even possible, just would freak out just being near any stairs. And again, some of these other dogs that we meet, and again, who knows what the range of their experience was when in the Vick world, but didn't apparently at least have those same kind of issues. So like you say, it's sort of like people, yeah, dog to dog, I guess. And then we also don't know just how extensive some of those experiences were, even differently from dog to dog while they were still there.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating thing to point out. I mean, it's not in the film, but in the film, we very clearly show that Little Red has issues walking through a door. Little Red's okay walking out of the door, the front door to the house of her new adoptive home, but really is not comfortable walking in, so she has to be carried across the threshold for months by her new adoptive owner, Susan Wydell. When we were filming Dogtown, Handsome Dan, who we also feature in the film, Handsome Dan also would absolutely refuse to go over a threshold to a home on a leash. Now, this could be for a number of reasons. I mean, the dogs probably lived in, you know, according to the photographs that we've seen, these runs outdoors. And so they probably never really went into a proper house. So they might have just been unfamiliar with life in a home. But it's, as Susan says in the film, the wonderful woman who adopted Little Red, it's not, I believe that animals are sentient beings. I mean, these dogs have hopes and dreams, and I've seen my own dog not only have nightmares at night, but I've seen her wag her tail as she's sleeping.
Yeah, she's dreaming. Yeah.
She's dreaming.
And what kind of dog do you have, by the way, Darcy?
I have a Chihuahua,
okay,
miniature pincher mix who I adopted from a kill shelter during the course of my time working on Dogtown. But, you know, I believe that these dogs have memories, and I don't think it's very unlikely, as Susan recounts in the film, that when she tried to get Little Red to cross the threshold to her home, that it reminded her, as Susan recounts, of being carried up into the ring. I mean, Little Red was clearly fought from the scars that are on her face.
Yeah.
So I have no doubt that could be the reason why Little Red didn't want to go into her home for months.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that's great about the film is that there is this focus, and we do get to meet these so-called Vic dogs and how they played out with their new families. But it does widen out to deal with a number of other issues sort of within the pit dog world, pit bull dog world. So I got a little tongue twisted there, but partly because I'm seeing, actually, let me just ask this first, because one of the things that the film deals with as far as some of those other topics is myths and misconceptions about pit bulls, because my email is blowing up here with people who are clearly, except for I think one, very strongly anti-pit bull. And I've already gotten four from one guy.
That's great, because these are the people who need to see this film.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, whether they will or not, because some of these people are quoting information that I think they think ostensibly proves their point. Like the first one starts off, "I love you, man, but don't agree with your take on these killers," and then quotes an information. And then there's a few other links and some of the other emails. And another email, I guess, refers to a phrase I used saying about it's all how they're raised. So this one says, "It's all how they're raised," in quotes. "What is the point of humans having developed over 400 breeds for specific purposes? Each breed has anatomical differences designed to perform the work for which they were bred. For instance, sighthounds have long legs and deep chest to run fast and good eyesight coupled with the inbred trait of prey drive. Retrievers have coats that provide insulation and cold water, fat around their organs to protect them, and the inbred trait to love water. Pit bulls have power, tenacity, and deadly jaws in order to perform the work of blood sport. If it is truly all, quote unquote, how they are raised, why don't dog fighters raise Italian greyhounds to fight? Why don't hunters teach chihuahuas to retrieve?"
That's a great question. Well, I mean, you know, these dogs were not raised to be bloodthirsty killers. As the film shows, these dogs were brought over from the UK because they were cherished family dogs. That's their history. You know, they were used as nanny dogs. They were once considered the all-American dog, as the film talks about.
Yeah.
I believe that it's the media that is guilty for the reputation that pit bulls have today. In the 70s, it was once the German Shepherd, the Rottweiler, the Doberman, and as the pit bulls started to sort of come onto the scene, it was really in the 70s, and these dogs have been vilified by, you know, they're very strong, they're very athletic. I think that people who have less than good intentions gravitate towards this dog because it makes them look tough, and that they abuse these dogs. I mean, any dog, if you neglect it, if you tie it on a leash and leave it in the backyard and don't feed it, any dog at length is going to get a little irritated. And, you know, it's not uncommon. There's an incredibly good article you may have read, since it sounds like you know quite a bit about this topic, called the Pit Bull Placebo. And it talks about dogs who bite. It's not uncommon, these dog bite stories. It's, you know, a dog who's been tied up in a backyard for months and months, probably starving, and this is actually recounted in what I've read, that, you know, the parents are smoking some kind of illicit drug, mm-hmm. and the two-year-old wanders unattended outside, accidentally into the backyard, you know,
yeah.
sort of situations. Of course the dog may bite, and whether it's a pit bull or not. And the other thing that happens is that these dog bites, when dog bites happen, sometimes they're even reported to be pit bulls when the reporter has no idea what breed the dog is. It's a better headline.
Well, that it's interesting you would say that, because I have done another number of shows related to pit bulls over the years, and I am very interested in it, and it's always extremely polarizing, as today has already been, at least on the email side. But one of those shows, I had someone call in that works for the major paper in the area and said that just from their own experience, when there's any kind of dog bite situation reported, even if it's clear or fairly clear what the breed is, they will always just say it's a pit bull or pit bull type dog.
Mm-hmm. It's a better headline itself for the paper.
Yeah. So the problem with that is that then that leads to a lot of other misreporting and information, some of which, again, is what people are quoting when they're making their case about what sort of inherent killers there are. And again, some of these things are just opinions, and some of these people that are emailing, nothing we say or even probably, unfortunately, the movie is going to change their mind. I hope it might at least alter their position a little bit. But some people, I mean, these things are very firmly held beliefs, and it's, for a variety of reasons, I guess, very emotionally charged.
I think that they are. I think that when people want to believe something that they want to believe, they're going to continue to believe it. And I think that it's a testament to the good work that the media has done in reinforcing these beliefs. They've done an incredibly good job, and they've done it for years. And, you know, these pit bulls are undoubtedly considered, you know, a tough macho dog, or have been for years. And until more responsible dog owners start adopting pit bulls, and they have been. Since I've worked on Dogtown over the past 5 years, there are a number of advocates for pit bulls. They're not technically a breed, but I'm going to call them a breed, across the country. And organizations like Best Friends Animal Society and Bad Rap, featured in the film, who are doing such great work for these dogs, there are more and more people who are adopting these dogs, who are responsible owners, and who are provide, you know, loving homes. And I live on the Upper West Side of New York City, and there are a lot of people who have pit bulls. And, you know, I think their reputation is definitely changing. And they're hopefully well on their way to reclaiming their position as the all-American dog.
Well, it's funny. First of all, let me remind people again who might just be tuning in. I'm speaking with Darcy Dennett, director of The Champions, a documentary tracking the pit bull rescued from Michael Vick's dog fighting ring, and exploring other issues within the world of pit bull dogs. So you're welcome to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So, yeah, so one of the things that when you're talking about living where you live and the dogs that live, you know, that reminds me of one thing I definitely wanted to touch on here, which is breed discrimination laws, because that's really significant, and there's a really important, poignant part of your film that deals with that directly. And, of course, I guess it goes without saying that these are pretty much aimed at or against pit bull dogs. And one of the interesting statistics that's in the film was about, I think, 250 fatal dog attacks, and the breed could only be determined in 17% of the cases. So that's the kind of thing that gets bobbled and misreported later, so then somehow the lion's share are pit bull dogs, but really, in fact, it couldn't be determined what the kind of dogs were that were responsible for the vast bulk of those attacks.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that, as we've talked about before, I think the media does do a really good job of vilifying these dogs. It's in our best interest to do so. Now, look, I mean, there are definitely pit bulls who have bitten, and I would be willing to wager that most of those dogs probably don't have responsible dog owners. You know, I have my dog Nina, who's a lovely dog and only 20 pounds, so she's not strong and athletic and can't really do any harm. She does not like other dogs. So, you know, she's fine when she's off leash, but if she's on a leash and I'm walking her down the street and she goes past a very nice pit bull, she's going to lunge at that dog. And, you know, I know my dog really well. I have a very good sense of how she's going to react. Now, should she be euthanized? Should she be killed because she is not good with other dogs? I think that I'm able to manage it. So, I mean, every dog is an individual. There are definitely pit bulls who aren't good with other dogs. There are definitely pit bulls who are good with other dogs. As you say, these dogs have a bad reputation. They are reputed to not be good with cats, to not be good with children, that they can snap, that they can be great and then just one day act out in aggression. These things make very good stories. And again, if you have dog owners who are irresponsible and mistreating their dog, then all of these things are possibilities. But even, you know, many of these dogs who were rescued from Michael Vick's dog fighting ring, even these dogs who have been so abused and mistreated by humans, even these dogs have proven that they can go on to live, that they can forgive people. They can learn how to trust again and go on to live happy lives in adoptive homes. And I think that's a real testament to the disposition of pit bulls as a breed.
Darcy, we're sort of running near the end of our time. There's a few things I just know we're not going to get to. So let me just briefly touch on, although I would have loved to have spoken with you more about it, but the breed discrimination thing that I started to talk about. Just let me just mention that Mark Burley is a pro baseball player. I'm sure a lot of people know him. And so one part of the film looks at Burley, who got traded to the Miami Marlins, and in Miami there is a breed discrimination ban on pit bulls. So the family talks about how they had to live sort of outside that area, even though that's where Mark played baseball. And then, in sort of a weird improbable thing, he got traded to Toronto, which is in a province that has a pit bull ban. So you really see them as a family grappling with what to do, and they're not going to do anything to leave behind their pit Slater. So, and a thing that just has stayed with me, you see that they decide that Mark's going to move by himself to Toronto, and you see the scene where he's by himself FaceTiming with his family because they've just decided that's what's best for the family and the only thing that's fair to Slater.
So. Yes, I think it's a great story, and I love their story, that they were so generous in sharing with us. I mean, what isn't in the film is that, you know, Mark really, and it's a testament to how much the family loves the dog. As Jamie says, she wasn't going to give up their dog Slater because their kids were in love with the dog. They also were at the age where they were going to school. As a pro baseball player, I guess the schedule is incredibly demanding, so you're often on the road. So, I mean, I think there were a number of factors that went into their decision-making, but at the end of the day, they really believed that they weren't going to give up this dog because of the prejudice and the misunderstandings and misconceptions about this breed, that they weren't going to cave into that.
Right, and I think they took a lot of criticism because, again, the family obviously was split up, at least during baseball season, and people said, well, why would you do that? And I think they felt like, hey, we have a commitment to Slater. No, it's not ideal, but we're also sending and teaching a lot of messages and teaching a lot of things to our kids about sort of what's important, and you don't just discard a dog because suddenly it's become sort of an inconvenient part of your day-to-day living. And anyway, so to me, it was just very profound and poignant, just as a way to deal with that whole breed discrimination aspect. So let me get at least one call in before we're probably just about out of time here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Darcy Dennett.
Hi, this is Ernest. How you doing, man?
Good. How about you? Quick question for Darcy?
No, not a question. It's a statement. I think it's humor that they do this, and I also think it's in the way kind of racist.
Well, I'm sorry, what is the racist part? I missed that.
Well, when it was white America fighting people way before blacks did, it didn't reach this level. But when blacks started fighting these dogs, then it flipped over. Like Colorado Springs, you cannot have a pit bull and cut. They'll shoot it on spot.
Okay.
I'm happy to respond to that.
Okay, so thank you for your call. Darcy, go ahead, please respond. Thank you for your call.
Well, in the film, we have dog fighters of all different races. I think it's unquestionable that Michael Vick's fame and notoriety certainly helped to shed a light on this story. But, you know, there are people who are black who fight dogs. There are people who are white who fight dogs. There are lots of people who are black who don't fight dogs. There are lots of people who are white who don't fight dogs. For me, it's not a question of race. It's a question of doing something that is... really, whatever color you are doing something that is really incredibly mean. So for me, it's not a question of race.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for your call, and thank you for your response, Darcy. And let me, there's a few more calls. I don't know if we're going to have time for more than maybe one at the most, but let me, before we go and before we do run out of time, let me first say that your own website is Darcy Dennett, DarcyDennett.com. And the film website is championsdocumentary.com. So for people that want to find out how they could see the film, I think now you could download it if you were so inclined. There's tug screenings around in different cities. So far, I don't think there's anything in this area. In fact, I didn't see anything last time I checked in Florida, but I'm sure that's going to change. But again, to stay abreast of this, and if you just choose to buy and download the film yourself, any of that information can be found at championsdocumentary.com. All right, let's try to take one more call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Darcy Dennett.
Hello.
Hello. Did you have a question or comment quickly for Darcy?
Yeah. Yeah. My question is this. I've got a golden retriever at home. And when I brought her home as a puppy, I threw the ball, and she instinctively knew to run and get it and actually bring it back to me. I threw the ball out there. She couldn't find it. She started doing circles until she finally found the ball. And, I mean, I didn't have to teach her that. It was, she already knew it. I mean, it was, you know, part of her breed. And I always thought that pit bulls were bred for killing rats. And they have an instinct for killing. Am I wrong in thinking that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that there's a scene in the film where there's a dog fighter from the South, this man with white hair, as you'll see, and he's being interviewed by a reporter who's got these puppies. And the reporter asks, "Are you going to fight these dogs one day?" And the guy says, "Yep, probably will." And for me, you know, I see these puppies as a blank slate, you know, like children. Our dogs, most dogs would really rather, like animals in the wild, if you fight, you're putting your life at risk. Most animals want to preserve their life. If they fight, they could die.
Okay, but my question was the instinct part, the part that isn't trained. It's not learned behavior. It's something that the animal is born with. I mean, does the pit bull have an instinct that it's born with to kill?
I don't think so. I mean, as the film very clearly shows, dogs are individuals, regardless of breed. I mean, look, I spent months filming with these dogs rescued from Michael Vick's dog fighting ring in their run, very close to them. It was ultimately here in New York City. I was at a dog run. This spaniel, this innocuous-looking spaniel, gave me its paw two times and then promptly bit me full on the face. So, you know, I think it really is animals are individuals. Do animals have prey drive? Sure. Different types of dogs have prey drive.
Thank you so much for your call.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Darcy, so I think we're just out of time, but just as a measure of some of the emotion that we've talked about, that this issue stirs up, and some of the emotion that's even being presented in some of my emails. One of the emails, actually it's a text, says, and I'm sorry, this is about you, but I'm just giving you a measure of what kind of exchange we're having here. Now it says, "Now she is just plain out lying."
Ah, that's so funny. Well, listen, I actually really welcome this kind of thing. The response to the film has been overwhelmingly positive. There have been very few comments like this. So for me, I'm like, great, bring this on.
Yeah.
These are absolutely the people who should see this film.
Yeah, I just hope they will. That's the thing, because, again, some people just think are so locked into their position and feel like they've actually done research, however flawed that research might be, to cement their position. And so some of these folks just may not be open to other information that would clear up some of those myths and misconceptions that they're operating from or alter their position. But I hope some will, and a good way to do that would be to see the champions, because there's really a lot of information. Even some of the myths that you hear all the time about their jaw power and how their jaws lock, which has, of course, been refuted years and years and years ago.
Yeah, Brady Barr of National Geographic actually did a test to see how much bite pressure different breeds had, PSI pressure, and I believe it was the German Shepherds that won that contest.
Yeah.
I mean, any large dog. My friend has two German Shepherds. They're big dogs. I'm a little afraid of them.
Yeah.
I think it's wise to be careful when you're dealing with large dogs. They're animals.
Yeah, that's... You know? Yeah. Well, Darcy, thank you so much for making the time to join us in Talking Animals. Again, the film is The Champions. The website is championsdocumentary.com for more information. And again, keep tracking screens that may at some point include some Florida screenings, or there's other ways to see the film if you're interested in doing that. So thank you again, Darcy, for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you so much, Duncan. Thank you.
In a few moments, I'll chat briefly with Erin Greenwood about that piece she wrote for BarkPost, examining the animal shelter run by PETA at its headquarters in Norfolk, Virginia, and the eye-opening figures on euthanizing the animals that land there. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner, a slightly unusual version today, in that it's not a stand-up set per se. It's Dave Attell sitting and talking with Conan, doing panel in comedy parlance. Plus, it starts with a visual element that's a little tricky for radio. But Attell is truly one of the greats, has been for decades, and as a measure of that, listen to how hard Conan laughs at Attell's stuff. That's rare for Conan to, I think, respond that enthusiastically. This is Dave Attell from last Thursday on Conan in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
So you know what I did? I went to the Central Park Zoo in New York City. In fact, I have a picture. Can you guys put it up?
Sure.
Look at that. Yeah.
Oh.
Conan, I'm the one on the left.
Yeah.
All right, there you go.
Two old goats, that's what I call it.
You have a good time at the zoo? Did you enjoy yourself?
Well, actually, now that I look at it, I think that was a Tinder date. I apologize. I enjoy the zoo. I love animals. Do you? Do you like animals?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Why not?
There's some animals that I think we can, you know, I don't know, like a lizard. Like, that's a big pet now, lizards, you know? For those of you who think you might want a lizard as a pet, here's what you should do. Go home, draw eyes on a shoe, and talk to it. All right?
Not a dynamic pet, no.
Not a very, yeah, right there. And, you know, New York City, dogs and cats rule. You know,
yeah,
they really do.
Sure.
And we're the cat people, because we'll talk about you guys first. Yeah. Cat people are great. I know cats are the gateway pet to hoarding, but I'll tell you. No, dogs, you know, like, they're very, very sophisticated now. They, in fact, like, you know, my roommate's dog is on Ambien because he has nightmares. Can you believe that?
Yeah. The dog has nightmares.
Dog nightmares.
And it's on Ambien?
Yeah.
The nightmares?
Yeah. Now, I cannot believe, like, a dog would have a nightmare because I think they have a great life. I mean, they don't work, you know? I mean, they just play and eat. I mean, I'm like, looking at the dog, he's just yelping and barking and his paws are moving. I'm like, what is it, boy? Is there a ball under a couch in your mind somewhere? Was there someone at the door, but they weren't there, and then you thought they were there, and you had to run back and forth? Is that it? I never know what to do when you see a dog having a nightmare.
No, 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 yeah, no, it's not much.
I just pull up my pants and leave the room.
All right, listen.
How to get one in there. I had to try it.
I had to.
Took it into the gutter, I apologize.
You really, you had to do it. You did what you had to do.
I did.
That was Dave Attell with part of his appearance last Thursday on Conan. Let's move now into our conversation with Aaron Greenwood about the piece you wrote recently for Bark Post, delving into what goes on in terms of euthanizing the animals that end up at PETA's animal shelter. Regardless of your view of PETA, this may be some surprising information. Well, let's welcome Aaron Greenwood now to Talking Animals. Good morning, Aaron.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You bet. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So first, give us the nickel tour of the Aaron Greenwood story, a little bit about your background.
Sure. I used to be a lawyer, and then I went from that to being animal welfare editor at the Huffington Post for a while. And recently I left there to join BarkBox as a consultant. I'm helping them launch an online fundraising platform for dog causes, and I'm writing for Bark Post.
For those who haven't had a chance to check it out maybe yet, what is Bark Post?
Bark Post is a fantastic publication that I would really urge your readers to check out. We have all kinds of great dog stories there, stories about the science of dogs, dog rescue stories, stories about great products that dog lovers are going to enjoy. It's the website that's affiliated with BarkBox, which is the monthly dog toy subscription service.
So I think that brings us perfectly into your piece about PETA, which we should probably note is an op-ed. But nonetheless, yes. tell us about the piece and what some of the key elements were.
Sure. So PETA, a lot of people don't know this about PETA, but they run one animal shelter at their headquarters in Norfolk, Virginia. And it's a high-kill shelter, which surprises a lot of people. They take in a few thousand animals a year, and they kill, you know, last year they killed 72% of them, 72.8% of them, which was a little bit down from the year before. The year before it was 80-something percent of them that got killed. And it's a very controversial shelter, as you might imagine.
And so tell us a little bit about what is the philosophy that PETA has behind running the shelter, and therefore in some ways kind of what may account, at least from their standpoint, for that very high kill rate.
Sure. Well, what PETA says about their shelter is that it's a so-called shelter of last resort. They claim that it's not a traditional shelter where animals, you know, go with the hope of being adopted into homes, but that it's a place where low-income people from the community can bring their sick and injured animals to be euthanized at no cost, which sounds like a great service. The problem is that there's a real lack of transparency in how they do their work there. PETA has been asked, I've asked them multiple times, I'm far from alone in doing this, to just tell us how do they decide that these animals are so sick that they have to be euthanized? You know, what sorts of efforts do they put into finding them homes? Do they put any efforts into treating animals there? And they've just steadfastly refused to answer any questions, despite coming under a a lot of scrutiny and criticism for these practices.
And Aaron, isn't an underpinning of that philosophy a broader PETA philosophy that suggests, and correct me if I'm wrong because you're much more steeped in this than I am, but that I guess it amounts that animals in some cases should die to be saved?
It's kind of a chilling philosophy, and at the same time, I think all pet owners kind of have some sympathy with this philosophy that, you know, that there are times that death is better than life for some animals. You know, we've all been in the heartbreaking position of having to euthanize a pet, and we all know that, you know, that however much that hurts, that sometimes it is the kinder thing to do. PETA sort of applies that philosophy, it seems to observers like me, a little overbroad. Hard to see how 1,500 of 2,000 animals who came in last year were all better off dead. But that does seem to be the philosophy that's guiding their practice.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, please go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, the piece is deeply researched, almost like it was written by a lawyer. And so here's the thing, I guess I wonder that this may have been part of what you found in your research. I mean, I can't remember offhand how long ago they started the shelter operation there.
You know, that's a good question. I'm actually not sure what year it started.
Okay.
It's been around for a while.
Okay, because I guess my larger question is, you know, why, maybe depending on how long ago they launched it, but almost regardless, like why they feel compelled to operate a shelter that sort of shows these kind of numbers and follows these practices when they're ostensibly in the animal welfare business.
Yeah, I mean, you're asking a great question. It seems to be in some ways that they are just sort of stubbornly holding on to the shelter. That, you know, that they almost enjoy the criticism of it. It's really hard to give an answer to that question.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, they seem to feel that this is an important part of their work, despite the fact that it draws so much negative attention to their other practices. And PETA, you know, don't get me wrong, PETA does some great things. I'm a near lifelong vegetarian myself. I really appreciate their efforts to try to show people how easy and great it can be to not eat meat.
Sure.
I really appreciate their work, you know, on behalf of farm animals. I think all this is really good. They also do a lot of work providing free spay and neuter surgeries, which are, you know, it's very important work. It's very hard to see why they continue to operate this really troublesome shelter at their headquarters when it seems at odds with so much of their philosophy, so much of their mission, and it draws so much negative attention to their other work.
Yeah, well, that's exactly why I raised the thing, because these days there are a number of other practices, campaigns, et cetera, that draw criticism, which they don't obviously seem to mind, and sometimes they relish,
right,
or sometimes sometimes it's designed that way.
Sure.
But this seems kind of even outside of that realm a little bit. I guess I'm sort of stymied in trying to figure out why it makes sense to them now to have a shelter that they run that way, that has the results it has, and that has pieces like yours and others that raise these very questions. It just seems like, what's the upside at this point for PETA?
I mean, I think, you know, trying to get inside their head, I think they would say that they're providing an important service. They think that they're doing the right thing there.
Okay.
You know, they defend their shelter. They say that this is important work that they're doing there, and they sort of steadfastly refuse to adopt any modern sheltering program practices that anyone can see. I mean, they don't even list their pets online.
Yeah.
On Pet Finder. And they apparently have some buried page on their website where they list a handful of pets who are up for adoption, but, you know, they seem to just sort of stubbornly resist adopting any modern sheltering practices there.
Yeah.
And just keep saying that they're doing the right thing by killing all of these animals.
Well, that's, again, it just seems to underscore kind of the puzzling aspect. Yeah. So Aaron, we're sort of out of our time here, but for people who would want to find the piece that we're discussing, what's the best way they could search for it online, or where can you send them?
If you look on barkpost.com, there's an op-ed there called "Peter's Shelter Euthanized 72% of its Animals Last Year. That's a Problem and It Needs to Change."
And that's the piece.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, Aaron. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. Again, it's a piece very, very worth reading. Again, really well researched, and there's a lot of, even if it's kind of eye-opening, some really important information there. So thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up at 11 on WF, normally it would be Rob Lori and Radioactivity, but today it's Alternative Radio. Meanwhile, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a pair of tickets to see Ry Cooter, Sharon White, and Ricky Skaggs April 2nd at the Strass Center. Wow! Right now it's time for Animal News and Announcements. Starting with something happening today. It's Poker Poochapalooza, a poker walk pup crawl on foot in downtown Dunedin to help the Dunedin Dog Rescue. So again, that's today, March 9th, and registration starts at 4:30 p.m. at Clear Sky Cafe. Don't have time to get into all the details, but surely if you go to DunedinDogs.com, you can find out, and it sounds like it's going to be a fun thing for you and your dog. Also, a notable piece of news for people that track SeaWorld's goings-on, as we do here at the show. News came yesterday that, well, I'll just read this thing. A 35-year-old killer whale that was connected to three deaths and became the focus of the Blackfish documentary on SeaWorld's orca is seriously ill, the company said Tuesday on its Facebook page. Tillicum is suffering from a bacterial infection in its lungs. SeaWorld Orlando said he does have what we believe to be a respiratory condition that is extremely difficult to treat, SeaWorld veterinarian Scott Gearhart said. Tillicum has undergone treatment, but the whale's condition continues to deteriorate. Gear said there's no cure for the condition. Doesn't sound good for Tillicum. Okay. Anyway, all right, let's quickly get into Name That Animal Tune. Please only participate if you haven't won something in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize. Again, that pair of tickets to see Ry Cooter, Sharon White, and Ricky Skaggs April 2nd at the Straz Center. The first person calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. If you have a guest, we'll take it offline because we have just about reached the Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Largo, Weeki Watching and Beyond, Community Conscious Radio.